Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Disney vs. Disney Debates, the podcast where we're trying to figure out exactly what is the best Disney film ever made. I am your host and Grandmaster Zane C. Weber, here with two trusty debaters to tell me which is the better film between Atlantis, The Lost Empire, and Mulan.
Woo!
And fact-checking us today is none other than Carly Skelton.
Hello, Zane C. Weber. Thanks for having me.
How are you going, Carly?
Good. Very good. I'm interested to see what happens.
Oh, do you have any biases to declare in this debate?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Care to declare them?
Yeah. Eddie Murphy voicing a small dragon that's got sass. You can't win. So you had a bias against me the last one.
I did indeed.
Carly Skelton is going for Mulan.
Okay, well, defending Mulan, we have our trusty static debater. You just stay in the same place, and everyone.
I just live here now. This is my home.
It's a nice.
This is Stacey Hobbs arguing on behalf of Mulan today, and once again arguing for Atlantis. We have
veteran old Maddie. That's right.
Veteran old Maddie, that's right, is what he's calling
this
himself.
This title is getting more and more extensive each time. I feel like by the end of the final round, it's going to be like, oh, Maddie, oh, boy, oh, Maddie.
You'll have to take a breath.
The plan is that my business card will be like a rolling red carpet that unfurls before me as I enter rooms.
Yes.
Just wear a URL on a t-shirt.
Okay. <bit-ly> link. So we are once again in our second round of debates, which means that we have a 6-minute opening for the pros of your film and the cons of your opponents. At 5 minutes, you'll get a warning that sounds like this. And at 6, you'll be rudely cut off by Darkwing Duck saying,
"The jig is up, you jaded, jug-headed jack-in-the-box."
He is pompous.
He is.
Why are you doing this, Darkwing? We're on the same side.
But he gets the message across, guys.
He very much does. So we have rolled the dice and determined that old Maddie will be going first. So with no further ado, you have 6 minutes and your time starts when you start talking.
De Gim. That's greetings in Atlantean. That's right, my friends. Atlantis the Lost Empire is not only the greatest Disney film ever made, but I think it should really sink in that Dr. Mark Aucoin made its own damn language, complete with a unique alphabet, particular phonetics, and a dictionary. It's a language that's possible to learn fluently. There's a whole Wikipedia page dedicated to its depth and a video of the good doctor showing off some phrases. And that's not even mentioning the unique architecture and full mythos that was developed for the world of Atlantis. This depth and dedication to detail reflects the same depth and detail that pervades through this entire treasure of a movie. It's a movie filled beyond the brim with non-stop gusto, leading to a goosebump bonanza of a climax. A daring artistic experiment for Disney filmmaking, showing the best of their animation department's versatility. Atlantis dares to move on from the formulaic nature of Disney's song and dance and cutesy sidekicks to push the boundaries of animated visual storytelling, all while bursting with that beloved Disney magic of making classic tales like Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and making them fresh and relevant once more. Directed by Beauty and the Beast legends Gary Trusdale and Kirk Wise, this is no fairy tale bound forever to the past of our culture, but a story we can carry with us every day, along with its characters. Atlantis has such a wide array of interesting and charismatic characters, all of which actively help propel the plot forward with such natural humanity that I can confidently say no other Disney film had such a fun supporting cast, all of which were impeccably casted to suit that they ground the high fantasy into not only history, but into our world. They're not cute. They're not simple. They're people with hopes, dreams, regrets, and compromises they never knew they made until it's time for them to each ask what they value and who they are. And when we see them all answer this question, and we understand why. It's remarkable, not least with the knowledge that actors like Don Novello were given the artistic liberty, as the whole film was blessed with, to improvise and break the mold and the mold of Disney films. The antagonist Lyle Tiberius, played hand in glove by likable maverick James Garner, proved to be a villain who you can't ultimately agree with, but you can't hate, until you see him as the spirit of capitalism. Oh, the scope of this movie thematically, musically, emotionally, technically, and visually, ye gads! But Mulan... Unlike the best Disney films like Atlantis, Pinocchio, Aladdin, and The Lion King, where decisions are made more often for the sake of art than commerce, the balance is out of favor in Mulan, whose only goal was to emulate its great predecessors rather than make the bold, self-assured strides that made them great in the first place. For the role of Mushu, Disney was aiming for top Hollywood talents in the vein of Robin Williams' performance as the genie in Aladdin, and approached Eddie Murphy, who at first balked when asked to record at the Disney studios. He then asked to record his voice in his basement at his Bubble Hill mansion in Englewood, New Jersey. The most vivacious personality in the movie kept the project at arm's length, literally, metaphorically having his paycheck shamefully slipped under the door. While Bancroft, one of the co-directors, Bancroft, suppressed the spirit of Mulan's Buddhist kind of cultural origin, being a Christian. Though the production team traveled to China to draw inspiration from landmarks and so-called culture, the co-director, declining to explore Buddhism on the basis of his own Western-centric faith, immediately betrays that this story is not set in China due to a desire to bring new depth and representation in Disney films, but as a gimmick aimed at aesthetic appeal and cheap publicity points. Chinese culture with his Western Christian faith, his co-conspirator, production designer, Hans Bucker, suppressed the culture in the visual department. Though he, the art directors and their team did a wonderful job of drawing inspiration from Ming and Qing dynasties for proper historical prod design, as well as turning the art style gorgeously toward Chinese paintings with watercolor and simpler, broader strokes, it's absolutely gorgeous, and I can't take away from that. But Bucker himself by curbing the artistic daring with a capitalist polish of Western sensibility, drawing his inspiration for composition, lighting, and staging to establish settings to enhance the characters from the silent era German expressionism, British and American epics of the 1950s and 60s, and the spaghetti westerns. Anything but Chinese filmmaking. Indeed, taking inspiration from spaghetti weapons to enhance Chinese characters with, might I add, Western technique, before taking from even Japanese filmmaker Akira Kurosawa is extremely telling, as Kurosawa himself inspired the spaghetti Western. The music is a great score and a great medley of Disney bangers, but even my favorite element of this film is marred by the blood sprayed by corporate cutthroats. The original desired composer, Stephen Schwartz, when he also accepted an offer to work on DreamWorks' Prince of Egypt, was threatened by the president of Disney Animation that his name would be stripped from Pocahontas and Hunchback of Notre Dame if he took the offer. Schwartz walked, and the company merrily found composers who would bow to their will. Mulan, from start to finish, is a stark, dark reminder of the business power of the golden age of Hollywood. A rotten apple of the Hesperides, a power that Disney still possesses, happy to exploit other cultures for a bankable story without committing to properly telling that story with cultural sensitivity, artistic integrity, and courage, like when a French actor played the wife of freaking Genghis Khan in 1965. Chinese people complained about Mulan's depiction as too foreign-looking, and the story as too different from the myths. It would be unfair to say that Mulan is a piece of art that doesn't know how to balance its elements or knows what it wants to be. It knows exactly what it is. It is a product. The only relevance and value that Mulan has in modern society as a film, not even mentioning the prospect of it being the best Disney film, is that it brought Szechuan sauce for chicken nuggies twice over, thanks to Rick and Morty. And boy, even that caused riots.
Oh my. Yeah. Is that it?
I could go on, but I'll save it for later.
Oh, okay.
I am so glad you brought up Rick and Morty. Oh, my life is complete. Just in that moment. That's great.
That was thick and fast.
I'm still fact checking.
Yeah, sorry.
That was a lot of information very quickly.
Is there any facts that you have checked that you would like to clear up now, or would you like us to throw to Stacey and then fact check in the break?
The whole Eddie Murphy keeping Mulan at arm's length is, as far as I can see, correct.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because that he wanted a bit of privacy at that time. Not that he didn't like the project, just to clarify that situation. Here we are. Yep, Spaghetti Western, that was all correct as well. Cool.
All right, no problem. We will pass over to Stacey with 6 minutes with a warning at 5 to tell me why Mulan is the best Disney film ever made and why Atlantis, the Lost Empire, is not.
Let's get down to business. Mulan is one of the key jewels in Disney's crown and deserves its place at the forefront of Disney achievements. And if you disagree, then dishonor on your cow. Where Mulan differs from other Disney films at the time is the motivations of the protagonist. We are introduced to a character who is not motivated by a love interest, but in protecting her family. Her family, consisting of both a father and a mother, another anomaly for Disney, are loving, but don't understand Mulan's true destiny. They support her when her matchmaking does not go to plan, despite how important that is for her culture and the family standing in the community. They protect her when she breaks Chinese law, and celebrate her return with unconditional love. The movie is solidly placed within a culture, featuring characters who are from that culture, who understand the history and legacy of what came before, who aren't coming from an outside understanding and forcing competing ideals onto a foreign culture. Where Atlantis uses the Atlanteans, implied to be people of colour from their design and Keita's voice actor, as a background to the action, sidekicks and plot derivatives to the bright white protagonists, Mulan provides a story that, while centered around a historical legend and set in a specific culture, does not make the culture a joke or a plot device. The story of Mulan does not occur about the culture, but within it, using the heritage and existing traditions to highlight the challenges faced by a character who belongs to that established world. Chinese culture is incorporated throughout Mulan in its music, animation, and themes. The animators wanted to incorporate Chinese art, architecture, and landscapes realistically in the film. In 1994, the production team sent a select group of artistic supervisors to China for 3 weeks to take photographs and drawings of local landmarks for inspiration and to soak up local culture. The Chinese-inspired aesthetics for the movie provides a serene backdrop to a movie that centers around war. With the use of soft watercolor-like effects, Chinese swirls and dust, clouds and fireworks, and gorgeous calligraphy in the opening and closing scenes, as well as other scenes featuring text in the film. The movie also features a multicultural voice cast, including the talents of Ming-Na Wang, Lea Seonglong, Eddie Murphy, B.D. Wong, and George Takei. The movie is a great introduction to Chinese culture, and I've literally used the movie this week to educate students about ancient China. While Disney did face some criticism, as Maddie said, from the Chinese people for westernizing the legend, the movie did more than what Hercules and Aladdin did. It tried to represent the culture sensitively, reimagined a Chinese legend, which in its own country has various versions, and introduced the West to a culture outside its own. And it wasn't completely lost on the Chinese audience. 10-year-old Tang from China learned to be fearless and just go ahead. He liked Mulan, even though she was a woman. Mulan is an incredible character, and it's even better that she is an incredible woman as well. Through Mulan, we see a young woman find herself. Due to her own determination and persistence, we see her confidence and agency increase. Interestingly, in a single throwaway moment, we see Mulan's motivations change and grow as she discovers her own power. While her initial intentions to join the army were to protect her father, we see these take on a new life. Mulan is offered the chance to return to her home and safety without being discovered as a woman. After struggling with the training during "I'll Make a Man Out of You," a banger, we see Shang sending Mulan home. It is at this point that her duty would be resolved. However, she chooses not to do so. She chooses to stay, persists in her training, and excels. We see her outrunning her male counterparts. We see her strength, agility, and prowess in battle, equal to or surpassing her fellow soldiers. We witness her brilliance in strategy, her ability to make quick decisions, and stand by her convictions and integrity. But what strikes me is, in all of this, her gains do not erase her strength and her emotional intelligence. Her empathy, compassion, and respect does not waver. She celebrates these feminine traits, and they were not demonstrated as being in conflict with her strength, intelligence, or agility. Mulan even took this further in demonstrating the limits of the society views of others. She's not listened to when she is female, despite having the same intelligence and skills. As Mulan says, why is Mulan any different to Ping? While the goal of the movie is not to directly confront the sexist view some peoples and cultures have or have had of women, it is a present tension in Mulan and is dealt with well while respecting the culture. Contrast Mulan with a female protagonist in Atlantis, Keita. She's supposed to be brilliant, intelligent, brave, and daring. However, when she reaches her peak power, she does nothing more than simply walking into capture, dooming Atlantis to ruin. Despite the 8,000 years she and her people have had to redecipher their own language, Milo does so in no more than 10 years in a foreign country with no knowledge of the spoken language or cultural historical events that contextualize the text. Furthermore, the story centers around a straight, white, male stranger coming in to rescue what is supposedly a far more advanced civilization, which which makes for some very unwoke undertones. While both Atlantis and Mulan have scenes where hundreds of people die in a few seconds, the way that the movies use these scenes to further the plot and the aftermath of these scenes are treated very differently. When Atlantis kills off hundreds of innocent crew, it seemed to simply lessen the work of the animators to tell a story. It's cheap storytelling tactic in order to move the centre around a smaller crew. The crew immediately forget these deaths and act like they never happened incredibly quickly. In Mulan, both mass deaths are used to contextualise the war. The first, the slaughter of the of part of their army, including Shang's father, and the second being Mulan's defeat of the Han army. In the first scene, characters are portrayed as mourning. Mulan shows compassion for an unknown child, for Shang. It sobers the entire battalion and puts meaningful stakes to the premise of the movie. War is serious and has consequences for the entire country. The avalanche scene again raises the stakes to the Chinese people who are defending the country. They are outnumbered by an incredible force of ruthless warriors who would surely spread their devastating destruction over all of China. Mulan defeats this army with minimal bloodshed, sparing the pain and suffering of many. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the music again. The music is incredible and is a simple effect of blending the comic moments with the harsh realities of conflict. Mulan holds its own and deserves its place in the Disney Renaissance among the best of what Disney has to offer. The movie's vibrant animation, rousing and catching songs, characters and message are empowering not only to girls and women but to boys and men. The movie provides Western audiences with a perspective that bravery, intelligence, quick wit and gumption are not characters unique to the Western population, that other cultures are worthy of respect and their stories are worthy of being honoured.
The jig is up, you jaded jughead and jack in the box.
To the wire.
All right, before we take a break, are there any facts that need to be checked there, fact checker?
Everything was really clear. Good job.
Well done.
Yeah.
Woo. Hooray.
Hey, well, we'll take a quick break and we'll come back with a question and answer segment. Okay, question time.
Delivered with such delight.
Stacey.
Yes.
You accuse Atlantis of using character death and mass character death as a way of simply just reducing the cast size and focusing on a group of people.
Yes.
Doesn't Mulan do the exact same thing with the Huns?
Yes, but better.
Why? Why is that better?
So part of, look, Mulan is a children's movie that's dealing with war. That's icky to begin with. And you've got to kind of deal with that. The way that death is, and there are those two pivotal scenes that I brought up before. The first one being sobering, and that's the effect of war. And look, we don't actually see, in the training scenes, we see like all the other soldiers, but we only really see the core group, which is normal and typical. But we see that death, it's a sobering death, and it shows the reality of what this could be, that if these Huns invade China, they don't care. They're just going to slaughter everyone, kids, women. They do not discriminate. They will decimate. That's a really cool little, like...
Put it on a T-shirt.
She rhymed. It gives a reality where they've just been singing a song about, yeah, I want a girl, and then all of a sudden they're looking at this reality. The second death scene, yes, you could say that it's to minimise the Han, so that in that final battle scene we're not, again, having a whole army. We can just focus on these key, interesting characters.
In fact, that's the point that
which
I'm
is the point you're making. Yeah. But I think the other aside to that is that the way that Mulan gets rid of that army is the least human impact possible. So she fires one rocket and decimates the whole army in one go, which minimizes the damage to the Chinese. Because you've got to remember, Chinese are defending themselves. They're not they're defending. It minimizes
my point
their deaths.
Is not towards the motives.
Yes.
And whether or not we deal with it. Although yes. I will say that the mass murder that Mulan commits in service of her empire isn't really dealt with in any emotional way.
It's not.
But my point is, why is that narrative device different to what is in Atlantis?
Okay, all right. So,
the fact checker please calm down?
I just knocked over my water bottle. Sorry, guys.
You're
continue,
fine.
Please.
I think it's the impact, and that's where I was trying to ramble to, is that the decimation of the Huns saved China, saved them from this impact of the attack. In Atlantis, that deaths, they were worthless but didn't really have a point. They didn't save anything. They didn't make any, those deaths weren't to save other deaths. Those people, like, they weren't going into it like all old mate, enemy dude, what's his name? Help me.
Lyle Tiberius?
Yeah. All he wanted was the power. He wasn't there to, like, kill them all. He's happy to just take it and leave. So it's not like there was an army invading. It's not like killing all those crew saved any Atlanteans. It was just, oh, cool, they're dead
so
now.
Character motivations are what you're saying. It justifies the narrative device.
Yes.
Okay.
And the whole point of it was, it's in a war, people are going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Atlantis are like, it's a historical expedition. And yes, we find out later it's not just for the history's sake and whatever. Mm-hmm. But for their plot device, for what they wanted to achieve, those deaths were unnecessary. And so, like, why have that amount of crew in the first place?
So war is necessary.
But why have that amount of crew in the first place? Why not just go
with
the minimal crew?
In the story of Mulan, war is necessary.
Yes. Yeah.
So, Matthew. Milo?
Yes.
White savior? Question mark?
Question mark. I mean, yes, he's a white... He's the Western kind of avatar for the audience mm-hmm. who goes into the story mm-hmm. to explore a new culture. It's mm-hmm. not a new device for treasure hunting movies. Treasure hunting stories, for better or worse, usually worse, like time travel movies, they're inherently white-centric. Like, a white time traveler can go to pretty much any period of history...
And speak English,
assimilate. And same for treasure hunters. For us to make treasure hunting movies, Westerners, like other cultures, you know, would love making treasure hunting movies, and I'm sure they do. We want to, you know, kind of be the eyes of the audience because it's made from a Western perspective. So we take Western perspectives, Western adventurers to explore it. In terms of, you know, how he figures out technology that they haven't figured out for thousands of years, even though they're immortal. I mean, it's that age-old problem when you're looking at something for too long and you need a fresh pair of eyes. And in terms of the whole crew being white, they're not, you know, it's a very diverse crew. They're Italians, there's Cubans, there's French, there's Sweets, who's African-American. It's a diverse crew. I mean, Helga's German. It's not just about, you know, Americans saving the day, because as you say, they're not there to save the day. They're conducting a private war on Atlantis for power, just like Shere Khan or in Mulan?
Shan Yu.
Oh, yes, yeah. Shan Yu.
It's just like Shan Yu is conducting a war for political power to take China. Lyle Tiberius is conducting his own war to take, you know, power for himself, and he's a mercenary. And those deaths in Atlantis, to justify them, it's about every treasure hunt, you know, it starts off as a rollicking scientific jaunt, but then it has to have a sobering point of mass death for a point of no return. Like, these are the stakes when you seek this kind of power, for better or worse.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
It did. So I have one final question, which is to both of you. Now, Matthew, you'll get to answer first because you're going first. Now, it has been stated by both of you to varying degrees that Mulan is a product of the Disney recipe and that Atlantis is an experiment breaking out of said recipe. Tell me why your movie uses this better than your opponent's.
Very well. I've written this one down.
Well, please, at any point, an answer would be nice.
I see.
Do I get an extra point for answering immediately?
Yes, Atlantis was a new direction for Disney, and it's an anomaly. Like, it was a style that did not catch on. Why? Because it's too daring. It's too risky. Like, the best pieces of art, it can't be replicated when the synergy of animated musical comedies is too attractive, not only for entertainment value, but also for the way they spin off hit songs and stage shows and albums. This being unique adds so much more to its value because it's the pinnacle of what Disney can do with a classic story and an original concept, making a classic story new while bringing modern sensibilities to it that really are counterproductive for Disney. And I think that's what makes it so special, that this is the pinnacle of artistic kind of thematic daring on Disney's part, because they made an anti-capitalist story when Disney is like a capitalist conglomerate, and it always was. Like, that's not just even talking about like the modern empire that we have now, but even back then they were constantly acquiring things like Pixar, being having Steve Jobs and being a part of Apple and always growing.
Okay, if I accept that at face value, which for the sake of argument I will, because I'm sure that Stacey has things to say, what do you think that they could have learned from the production of Atlantis that they didn't moving forward? Because like you said, it hasn't been replicated. It hasn't been, they haven't really tried to do anything in this style again. Can you tell me what worked in Atlantis that Disney hasn't or neglected to put into their following films?
I would say what it did in Atlantis that they didn't replicate later on was liberty, in terms of giving the actors so much room to play and improvise lines, giving artists the technology they needed to combine, like, you know, CGI for like the Leviathans with the comic book style of, I can't remember his name, but the guy who did the Hellboy comics. That kind of freedom to just play with different mechanics and different lines in terms of improvisations, as well as just going full throttle into a pulp story that everyone's just passionate about, you know, less songs, more explosions. That kind of passion for a project without so much interference from formula and what works commercially for big albums was, you know, what makes it special.
Okay. Yeah. So throwing it over to Stacey. So Mulan, very much part of the Disney Renaissance model. With a nominal princess, if not a literal princess, can you tell me why this is a good thing and not something that is just a cookie cutter product?
I think what Mulan, look, yes, Mulan is, again, yeah, in the princess canon. She's not technically a princess. She's been adopted. But I think what she did was she took what had come before and had made it better. Before this, we had Ariel and Belle. So they're going to be who she's going to be compared to, both based on fairy tales. Mulan is based on a Chinese legend. And legends have big aspects of truth, big aspects of real people doing real things. And I think that was a departure from the fairy tales, and that this, there's a legend. And though there's many different versions of it, of course, like many, many stories that have come before Mulan, it has been Disneyfied. It is based on, rather than a fairy tale, a real life possibly could have happened story, which I think is really interesting. It gives it a new tension, because this is a could have been real life events, could have really happened in a way or a way like this, where Ariel and Belle are very much in a magical fantasy realm. I think the other thing that they built on is Mulan as a character. So. We discussed in the last debate, Ariel's character, very, very different to Mulan, very different motivations, very different, realizations of those motivations. Belle, they try to give him more spunk, give him more interest, but really didn't achieve much, where Mulan, she was motivated by family and duty and protecting her family. And then she had a choice, and I discussed it earlier in the debate, where she had a choice where she could have done that, saved dad, and then be sent home and gone back to the life shit she always had. And she had that out, and she chose not to take that out. She chose to better herself, and she chose to become this really kick-ass person and really reach her full potential and keep growing and developing while not compromising all of the things that made her who she was.
Okay.
So I think they used the model, sure. They've stretched out by using a real legend, which could place it in the real world context, but also built on that character to make her own and her gumption and very much more of a self-actualization than previous princesses before.
All right. So, thank you for your answer. We'll take a quick break now. We'll come back with closing arguments. All right. Time for closing arguments. You will each have 3 minutes to tell me why your film is the best, why your opponent's film is not the best, and do it eloquently. Matthew, we'll be starting with you, and you will have no warning. You'll just be cut off at 3 minutes by Darkwing Duck, and your time starts when you start talking.
Very well. The climax of Atlantis is, dare I say, the greatest spectacle of animation, liberating the action from gravity and the usual rules of animation, letting it careen thrillingly through the air with the full explosive energy once imprisoned in the written kabooms of comic books. The story of Atlantis is rousing in an old pulp science fiction classic from the outset, but the climactic scene lets it undoubtedly transcend the rest of Disney's classics. Will the movie signal a new direction for Disney animation? No, as I said. But Atlantis is unique. It's 20,000 leagues under the sea, set free by animation to look the way it always dreamed of looking. And I can think of no higher praise. Barge Shenin. That's thank you. In rebut to some of my learned friends' points, Kida is a very strong role model as a feminist kind of symbol. She fights like Mulan. And she constantly advocates for reform. It's prophecy that she gets turned into a diamond towards the end. That's not, you know, a comment on her femininity. Whereas Mulan, her value constantly comes from hiding her femininity. Indeed, even when she's revealed to be a man, to be a woman, she redeems herself to her fellow soldiers by doing the masculine kind of combat kind of things that she learnt to assimilate with them in the first place. She never at any time celebrates her femininity. It's always despite of her femininity that they like her in the end. Speaking of the brutality of war, that in Mulan, they never mourn. No matter the soul, like, there's never really any big scenes where they mourn all of the soldiers they've lost. And Mushu, who selfishly puts Mulan in harm's way solely so he can become a guardian again, like, he's out to get his own. He also has a cricket that propels no plot forward. The art designer himself hated the cricket, and they quoted. But moving on. It's a brutal movie. Yeesh. It is a war movie, yes, but I detest the idea that the best Disney movie of all time, the movie that represents the best of what Disney can be, is such a ruthless, amoral bloodbath. Unlike the charmingly mercenary cowboy Cowboy Tiberius, who has clear and terrifying real monetary motivation, Shan Yu's motivation is no more complex than a monster devouring the countryside, even jokingly implying the murder of a child when he says the little girl will be missing her doll. We should return it to her. What a voice. Oh, and he followed through, the doll being found amongst the field of corpses in the burned village. But the Huns are villains. Perhaps, in truth, they didn't literally shoot messengers with quite as much witty rapport in history, but I understand stakes need to be raised and the threat needs to feel real. But the brutality doesn't stop at the villains. Mulan is a mass killer, causing an avalanche that slew the majority of Shan Yu's army. Sure, she's a soldier, but that's different to dropping the equivalent of an organized bombing run without orders. Also, as Mushu is surfing down the avalanche, he pulls a Hun soldier out of the snow, then puts him back, leaving him to die, which he did. And you're thinking, oh, that's a Hun soldier. Who cares what happens to him? He also scares two Chinese innocents, and they dive to their death out of a building.
The jig is up, you jaded jugheaded jack in the box.
That's enough of that. Thank you very much.
I enjoy your rants, Maddie. Every time they bring me such joy.
I'm glad.
Okay, so we'll go straight over to Stacey, unless there are any facts that need to be checked.
No.
Carly's checked out. She's just like, what?
I did look at the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea in the comic book thing, and I couldn't really find anything, so I think it's more opinion-based and alliteration rather than
the art designer
facts.
I can get his name for you.
Yeah, in just, my research as well, the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea was very...
Mike McNola.
It was mentioned a number of times about the inspiration, so that's... I'll allow it.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah,
okay.
I just find it, Mike. Yep. Okay. We're good.
Let's pass straight over to Stacey. 3 minutes. Your time starts when you start talking as to why Mulan is the best Disney film ever made and why Atlantis: The Lost Empire is not the best Disney film ever made.
Atlantis is a very fun film. I will give you that. But who is it for? When I was watching it, I was very lost as to who that film was targeted towards. Definitely targeted towards Maddie. But yes. Yes, it's got these wonderful sci-fi elements. It's got this kind of pulp fiction kind of, like, it's a great movie. but it's misdirected. It isn't clear about who its audience is for, and it feels far more like an adult directed movie than a kids movie, and I think that's part of the reason why that wasn't adopted in the greater Disney canon, because it didn't fit with the ethos of Disney. As much as I love an adult film, as much as I love those films, I think Disney does better at that balance of adult and children, and I really don't think Atlantis hit the mark for kids at all in this movie, which made it confused. It was a confused tone. It was a confused direction, which I think led to its ultimate failure. And it is not as iconic. When you think of Disney films, it's really not as iconic in the canon, and I think that's another reason why for that. Look, Mulan is a brilliant movie. It fits into that peak Disney renaissance. It's one of those first movies you see. It is beautiful. The music is so catchy. You know you're going to be singing those songs when this debate is over. Definitely nothing from Atlantis. And it also has these amazing, fun supporting cast. Maddie said there wasn't. Mate, there is. Both animal and human beings. We've got Mushu, who, look, is a problematic character, but that's part of his charm. We've got Khan the horse, which is hilarious and is right up there in the best Disney horses. And that's a stiff competition to beat. Mm. And then we've got Kriki, who, yeah, he's just along for the ride. He's just chilling. He's just enjoying it, like all of the audience. We're just going along with him and just being caught up in this world. And we've also got these incredible soldiers. We've got Yao, we've got Ling, we've got Ching Po, who give this... who become Mulan's friends, who get to know her, and who immediately, when at the end they accept her, and there's that whole scene about them dressing up as the concubines, is hilarious, and it's part of embracing that feminine, that those two roles can be yin and yang, that they can support each other, and that they can complement each other, and the fact that they listen to Mulan and she really does take the lead, and all of that shows their embrace of her. Mulan is an awesome female warrior. She's an awesome role model. And this film and the fact that it introduces incredibly complex culture to a Western audience who may never have been exposed to that before, I think, is a really powerful thing for Disney to have done. Did they get it right 100% of the time? No, but they did a really, really good effort, and I think it's right up there with films like Aladdin and Hercules, but better.
The jig is up, you jaded jughead, right, and jack-in-the-box.
Dot, well done. Okay, I have a lot of squiggles on my sheet here. So please take some time to talk about what you liked about each other's films. Carly, feel free to chime in about your bias if you have one, and I will figure out what I'm going to say.
Can I just say, though, Zane's marking sheet, it looks like a map to the Mars.
Oh, mate. She's elaborate.
Furiously writing.
There's arrows and circles and scribbles and...
I have a system.
There's a system.
I don't know what it is yet.
I was really mad when I found out I had to come against Atlantis again, because it's such a fun film.
Yeah.
It's such a fun film.
I was terrified when we were slated again, because it is a fun film, but you already had one run at it. It's like, what is left unsaid? What's she going to do next?
And I really enjoyed Atlantis, and I hadn't watched it for such a long time, and I only rewatched it for the Atlantis vs. Frozen debate. And I got to the end, I was like, dang it, it's so good. What am I going to say that's bad about this? I had such a great time. Like, and you're right, it was such a different Disney film. It went a really interesting direction, and it made me think, and I know it's one of my criticisms about, like, who is this film for? But I think there is this, and I think more so now, especially with Japanese anime, where they're really developing this medium for an adult audience. And that's when I was watching it, I'm like, oh, this is just such an untapped medium for Disney and for these Western, you know, companies spitting them out. I mean... I really enjoyed it, and I think if it wasn't aimed for kids, I think it would have been really, really cool to see what they could have done with it without those limitations.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Mulan is one of my favorite of the Disney Renaissance. Oh. Like, I found it funny that they were talking about, like, so I got a quote that I never ended up using because I'm too nice, where, like, the art director, when they were talking about, like, because the executives wanted the cricket in it.
And yeah,
like,
can you fact check that, please, Carl?
And they're like,
is Matthew too nice?
And then they're like, where is cricket in the scene? And one of the art directors is like, who cares where the cricket is? I care where the cricket is.
They fought for that cricket. Whoever decided was like, no, he must be in there, and just kept like putting him in scenes, like, until the director's like, all right, fine, just shove him in there.
Like, like, he play, is it, if I'm remembering this right, he plays like a little sad violin at one stage. It's so cute. And
I literally gave the sidekick a sidekick.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. It's so funny. This, yeah, it's that little layers.
But Mushu deserved. He earned a sidekick.
Oh.
The scene where Mushu breaks the great stone dragon and then holds the head above. He's like,
yeah, I'm going to go find Mulan. It's fine. I'm going
to very disrespectful to Chinese, like, culture. Oh, my Lord. Unfortunately. But, yeah, it's but funny.
Very funny.
And it's like, I know I like went at him for this point, but I mean, Atlantis is a testament. I love anti-heroes. So to kind of have like the sidekick have his own kind of selfish motives. I mean, they're never really quite reformed, but to have him have his own selfish motives, it's kind of my jam because that's believable.
Like, yeah. It feels like, very
people
real.
People are flawed.
People are flawed. People can
I
be
also
flawed.
Wonder whether the Great Stone Dragon is actually canonically dead now that the statue's broken.
Like, yeah. You do think of that, you're like, but what?
What happens to the dragon?
One of my favorite like offhand gags is when they're talking about Mushu's previous, like, I guess, clients, and he's like a ghost with a beheaded head. Just holding
your
it, misguided glowering.
Led him to do his destruction. He's like, yeah, thanks for that.
I do like the reverence that they show ancestry and family within regards to Chinese culture, and I think that's really important as well. Yeah. And that's the thing that Disney doesn't do well sometimes. Yeah. And I think they did that.
Well,
I think they really tried. They really did try in Mulan.
Say absolutely something.
Okay, here we go. Okay.
They did try in Mulan, and I think it's pretty. I think it's pretty safe to say that overall, Chinese people weren't particularly happy with the way that they were represented.
Not at all.
But
I did some fact checking.
Having said that, now these are very two different films. One is pinnacle Disney product. The other is Disney experimenting and just throwing everything at the wall to get a fun adventure out there. And I think what we came down to is the difference in the audiences. So Mulan is an adopted Disney princess made for little girls. It's made for
boys.
It is made for boys, of course. It's made for everyone. Like, I love Mulan as much as anyone else. Yeah, I'm not saying that, but the same reason that they changed the movie Tangled's name from Rapunzel is so that they could approach a more gender neutral audience. I definitely think that Atlantis lent more into that little boy sense of adventure and excitement and didn't pay much attention to the Disney archetypes and tropes. So I think that's the big difference in these two films. So when it comes to, like, I agree that Mulan has an entertaining set of side characters. But they really don't compare to Atlantis' side characters when it comes to depth and breadth of character. Yeah. And also the arcs that they go through. Yes, you lose them and you lose some of them very quickly, but the ones that stick around, they definitely have thoughts and opinions on what's going on, and they're not just there for a punchline, which Cheng Po is just a punchline in every scene. So I think that's the character, and the character writing's definitely on Atlantis's side here. Now, Atlantis is famous for, you've brought it up in both times that you've defended it, less songs, more explosions.
Yes.
Unfortunately, with Mulan, about the same kind of
explosions.
Yeah. But with
also
songs.
Music.
So I don't think that really plays attention here. These are both adventure films. They both have very high action scenes. Yes, I think the scope of the animation is a bit more adventurous and a bit more ambitious in Atlantis. So I think that's a small point there. But the scope of Mulan's action can't be denied. These are both brutal films that deal with death in a very real way. But they deal with it in a way that isn't meant to like scare little kids.
Yes.
So I think I can't really give the dealing with death card to either film here. Mulan is iconic. It is iconic. Mulan is a great role model. However, it has a huge point against it, which is the negative reception for the culture that it was meant to be displaying and incorporating. And Atlantis got away with that because it was a fictional culture that they were
any Atlanteans out there offended?
Yeah. So that is the big part that I have to hold against Mulan. And there's one point that hopefully people will justify it for, which is the music. The music is I'll Make a Man Out of You, Reflection. It is a huge part of Disney and is a huge part of Mulan. And I think that is the tipping point that makes Mulan the better Disney film today.
Yes. Oh, well done.
Well, I love Atlantis, but I think your first argument that Mulan was the product of the Disney Renaissance using all that formula like that, and that is why it is what it is. It's iconic. It is kind of the epitome of what Disney was going to do. So congratulations, Stacey.
Thank you.
For winning with Mulan. Thank you for fighting so valiantly for Atlantis.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very interested to see the results in the Facebook poll on this one, because Atlantis was the surprise winner of the poll last time against Frozen.
It was.
And I was not anticipating that. But yeah, let's see how it fares against Mulan. So if you want to find that, that'll be on our Facebook page. You can also find us on Instagram and on Twitter or at our home on the web, thatsnotcanon.com. Thank you once again to Stacey for fact-checking us all the...
My name is Carly.
To Carly for fact-checking us all the way through to the end. And to Stacey for debating.
You're welcome.
And to Matthew for losing.
Bah.
Valiantly.
Valiantly. Very well fought.
We'll be back next time.
I went down like a flaming blimp.
With another debate for you. Keep watching Disney, everyone.
Bye.
I'm Morgan Phillips and I'm a human.
And I'm Isabella Vallette and I'm also a human. But I was raised by fairies. And now I'm taking my human friend Morgan in to meet all of the mythological creatures that I know.
Every Sunday we meet a new mythological creature and interview them about their life in a modern day context.
Such as?
The Night King from Game of Thrones.
Fenicula, the friendly vampire brother of Dracula.
We've met the Loch Ness Monster.
Santa.
The Volpertinger.
The Devil.
And a mermaid.
And many more.
We release all our interviews as a podcast called Off with the Fairies, where we interview a new mythological creature every week living in a modern day world.
Come join us.
That's Not Canon Productions podcast.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.